Thank you, Randy. Let's see. Oh, this is not for me to read. My name is Belinda Brown, and I'm an alcoholic.
I'm sorry.
You can call me Bonita. I've been called much worse to start with a B, so we're okay. We are okay. Yes. By the grace of God, sponsorship, and the rooms just like this, I've been sober since September 9th, 2004. And I am incredibly grateful for that, as is my family and my friends and my coworkers and anybody out there on the highways. Because I like to drive a lot drunk, you know. When I was thinking about driving up here to speak tonight, I thought, like, gosh, it's a couple miles away. But, you know, when I grew up in Lawrence, Kansas, they didn't sell liquor on Sundays, and I could never save it from Saturday night to Sunday. So I had to drive 45 minutes to get across the state line to get my liquor. But I'm a little nervous, so I'm going to tell you a story. It's one that I read recently. I've been reading up a lot on hope. Because when I came in here, I was so hopeless. I didn't think that this program would work for me. I didn't really think I was an alcoholic. And so, you know, I've gone through things lately, and I've just kind of, like, found that, like, hope is what I need a lot of. And the story that I read about was about a Chinese farmer who had a horse. And this horse was what the horse that plowed his fields for him. I mean, you know, when the season was over, he used the same horse to take his produce into the town. Him and this horse did everything together. I mean, he was his main transportation. One day, a bee stung this horse, and the horse ran off. And everybody said to this man, "Oh, you poor thing, you've lost your horse. That's such bad luck." He said, "Good luck, bad luck. Don't know." So he goes on with life, and the horse comes back about 3 days later, and he brings with him 6 wild horses. And this man is able to corral all these horses, and everybody says, like, "Hey, good luck. You know, you've got, like, 6 horses and your horse. You are so lucky." Good luck, bad luck. I don't know. So his son wants to, like, use these horses. So his son's trying to break these horses so that they can use them and just, like, have lots of, you know, sell them, use them, just do whatever. And the son doesn't know how to do this, so he breaks his leg in 3 places. So then, of course, this small town, everybody's in his business again. "Oh, that is so sad about your son. He has broken his leg in 3 places. How are you going to go on?" "Good luck, bad luck. I don't know." So then a war breaks out, and any male under the age of 50 is called off to go into war. They go into war, and they said, "Dad, it's such great luck that your son is not going, because everybody else is going." He says, "Good luck, bad luck, I don't know." But it turned out to be good for him, because all those men that left, they didn't come back. So, you know, with that story, it's like, I don't know when something is good and when something is bad. You know, on August 22nd of 2004, I got stopped at a roadblock for drunk driving at, I think it was 2 in the morning. I don't ever know why we drive at 2 o'clock in the morning. I guess, basically for me, I was trying to get home so I could get in bed, so I could get up and go to church the next day. Because I'm not a bad, I'm just sick. I was going to, like, go home, get a few hours sleep in, and then I was going to go to church and, you know, read and sing and do all that stuff. And then by noon, Food Lion would start selling wine so I could get me some wine, you know, because I lived in Virginia at the time. So I'm a little warmed up now, so I guess I'll tell you a little bit about me. I was born in Lawrence, Kansas. And it's like, if you were born there, you would drink, too. But I didn't stay there long. You know, I'm the youngest of 4 children. I have 2 older sisters and an older brother. Parents were divorced. My dad liked to drink a lot. We drank a lot together. But due to this disease, he died in 89. And so I drank for that for years and years and years, because it's like, you know, he died close to my birthday, so of course that ruined my birthday month. So I used the first half to mourn and be sad, and then the last part's to party. And then there was, like, always a reason for every month that came up for me to drink, so I just pretty much drank whenever I was awake. My mother, on the other hand, she doesn't drink at all. I know I've spilled way more than she's ever consumed. It just wasn't her thing. But give her some Teddy Grahams, and she's off to the races with those. So living in North Kansas was pretty boring and dull. I didn't go to college, even though it was a college town, until, you know, later in life I did do that. But I decided I was tired of driving back and forth to cross the state line to get liquor, so I moved to Missouri. So I had drive-through liquor stores, which was really nice. You know, you didn't have to get dressed, put on your slippers, and just go out there and, you know, get your ice and your soda mixers, cigarettes, because I smoked when I drank. You know, I was, like, always drinking and smoking. It's like, and I never could get the right mix, so I'd always have to go out and get more cigarettes to go with some more drink, or I have to go get more drink to go with the cigarettes. But it's just, that's all I did. Work, drink, smoke, pass out, get up, and just, like, maybe go to work, maybe not. Just kind of depend on how bad it got. So I lived in Missouri for a while, got pulled over for my first time there, and that's the first, that's not the first time that I got told to go to AA. I was actually kind of, like, had an incident when I was about 18, but you know, it wasn't a problem. I was just too young. That red light shouldn't have been red, and that car shouldn't have been going through the intersection, and I shouldn't have hit it. They should have gotten out of my way, but that's, you know, that wasn't a problem for me or anything. So I moved to Missouri, lived there, drank there, and then I decided that, you know, things weren't going so well there, and I had a job that moved me to Denver, and I thought I was going to be happy drinking there because they said with the altitude there, you could, like, drink less and get drunk more. Well, that lasted about maybe a week or two for me because I drank so much it didn't matter. And then I moved from Denver to South Carolina. I was shooting for Georgia, but I kind of missed. So I didn't like living in South Carolina much because they had, like, those big red circles on their stores for you to find them. So I was always like in search of like a red dot store. And by now I'm kind of like writing myself little notes like I really shouldn't drink so much when I'm drunk. And I'd read them the next morning. I couldn't really tell what it was, but I started writing letters to myself because I knew that there was a problem. You know, all this time I'm staying employed. I had been fired from a job, which I had to get sober to realize that, yeah, I had been fired. The other time I kind of left before they got rid of me. So finally, when I landed up in North Carolina, you know, I loved living there. That's where I got sober. And it was because of the DUI that I got. But, you know, all through junior high, I guess I started in junior high, middle school, whatever it is people call it nowadays, I started drinking then because that was the thing to do. It was the cool thing to do. I mean, I got decent grades, but I was kind of bored, and that's what my friends did. You know, I had a friend, and she would bring liquor to school in like little baby aspirin bottles, and then she'd come outside the hall, and we'd go out and sneak to the bathroom and drink out of baby aspirin bottles and, you know, do some other non-conference approved things. And I just continued to drink through high school, sitting in people's cars that I didn't know, drinking there, living in the college town, had fake IDs. I was, you know, going to campus parties and, you know, sneaking into the clubs. I mean, when I finally turned 21, they're like, you are just now turning 21. You've been coming in here for like 5 years. I'm like, yeah, isn't that great, you know? So I remember on that night, I got like a couple of pictures of kamikazes and just really did it up. And one of the things that saved me from getting into like a lot of trouble with the police was my sister had worked for the police station because they pulled me over a couple times and they're like, oh, that's Selma's sister, like, let her go. So I got to have a lot of heat growing up because, you know, I had like connections. You know, me and my dad drank, me and my oldest sister drank. I drank with whoever was willing to drink with me. But then once I, you know, the last few years of my drinking, it got very isolated. And it wasn't a pretty drunk. It wasn't the glamorous, beautiful, you know, see the cosmopolitan drinks. It was just kind of like drink whatever I could. On payday, I would like get that top shelf liquor and drink it. But then by payday, you know, the day before payday, they'd be like, what's down there? You know, it went from Captain Morgan to Sailor Sam or whatever that stuff was on the bottom shelf. And, you know, I never knew why my dad drank this real cheap $2.75 alcohol. I mean, I knew my dad was an alcoholic, and my dad had told me I was an alcoholic before he died, but I'm thinking like, yeah, whatever, you know, but I never understood why he would drink that cheap stuff, you know, but it's like, I guess because when you need the quantity that I needed that, I started drinking the cheap stuff too. I mean, I would like sit there and look at the liquor and think like, okay, this is how much per ounce am I getting? I went for the alcohol content, not the taste. I mean, I'd long gone past like caring what it tasted like. I don't care if I had anything to mix it with or not. It's just like, you know, if it spilled, I'd lick it off the counter. I mean, that's the way I liked my liquor. So, you know, I continued to drink, but I started isolating, you know, a lot because people would want to go out for a drink after work. And when they said a drink, they meant a drink. And they would just shut it down. And I'm like, the party's getting ready to get exciting now. You know, they're like, they can feel it in their head. They're just like, they better stop and have a Diet Coke now. And I'm like, do you mind if I finish it for you? Because I'm greedy, too. And I'll drink anything that's got some liquor in it, that's got alcohol in it, because I drank for the effect. You know, I didn't ever go out to have just like one drink of anything. And if I did, it was very uncomfortable. I didn't understand why. I mean, what's the point of getting liquored up if you're not going to be able to just finish it and just get bombed and just like go into blackouts? I mean, I had blackouts and I didn't know that was not a good thing. It's when I went through the treatment and they asked me about blackouts and I'm like, what are those? No, I don't do those. I'm not like that. So I did admit to brownouts, just like occasionally, like missing periods of time. I could wrap my head around that, like, yeah, it might be 6 o'clock and then I might come to and it might be 10 and my clothes may be on, may not be on, may be wrong. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what happened in those hours that missed in there, but no, I didn't have a problem with liquor. So the way I got to Alcoholics Anonymous was after that roadblock where they told me, I think my ticket said, like, danger to self and others. That really, really kind of like was an eye-opener for me. And I remember when they, the drive to the police station, it was like very humiliating. I felt like there's like, this is really bad this time, you know, because by now I'm like 42 years old. I was 42 then, and I'm thinking like, this isn't cute like when I was younger anymore. I mean, I could just tell I was in bad trouble. I mean, I just knew I wasn't going to be able to like weasel out of it this time or buy my way out of it, but I was sure going to try. So, when they finally let me out of jail, you know, like in downtown Raleigh, of course, they weren't going to give me a ride home. They kept my car, kept my driver's license, and I mean, I don't know what all happened. I kind of like, there's just kind of like little gray areas in there of my mind, but I knew I didn't have a driver's license anymore. So I decided the way I was going to like sober up and, you know, get better was like to walk home. I mean, I lived 13 miles from the police department, but I was going to walk home in last night's clothes, which wasn't too pretty a sight. So I got a little bit of the way there, and then I called a friend, and she came and got me and took my car home. But at the time in Virginia, to get your license back, you have to go through, like, this little, they want to just monitor you, test you out, and all that stuff. And I lied to the best of my abilities, and they still diagnosed me an alcoholic. I was just outdone. And, you know, in hindsight, when I've gone back and talked to the guy, he said, yeah, the whole time you were here, you just sat on your hands. And I'm like, oh, I sat on my hands? I'm like, I don't ever sit on my hands, but I sat on my hands. But I lied, and so they put me in that little outpatient for 90 days thing. And I was in there with a bunch of people that didn't want to be sober. I didn't really think I had a problem, but I wanted my driver's license back. And they were telling people in the rooms that they need to go to AA meetings or NA meetings or CA meetings or just whatever their A was. They need to go to meetings. And I'm like, nobody was telling me that I need to go to a meeting. And I was the only black woman in there. So that's when my mind started telling me, like, this is a trick. They are doing studies on the effects of a black woman in a room with a bunch of addicts and alcoholics. I am a test sampler. And then it's like my mind said, but they're taking your money from you every week. They're compounding interest about 5%, and I'm going to get money back. Because they're going to, like, say that this is how you people affect people like me, good people, you know. But that didn't happen. And I started, and so I decided, like, well, since they're not telling me to go to those meetings, I'm going to go to one of those meetings myself. And then when I got there, it's like, it was like love at first sight. You know what I mean? There's all these men outside smoking cigarettes. And I'm like, this is where all the men are. So I'm like really excited, you know. And I can't tell you what happened in my first meeting and what was said, but I just knew that I felt like it could be okay to come back. I mean, a bunch of women gave me their phone numbers and everything, and I was all excited and everything. And I came back the next night. I mean, I picked up a white chip that night because when they passed out white chips, everybody was looking at me because I was the only new person in the room. So I kept going and kept going. And finally, on a Saturday, I met the woman that would be my sponsor later on because they said, you know, get a sponsor and get a home group and all that stuff. But I usually, like, peeled out as soon as possible. I just wanted people to, like, know that I was there and I was listening to this stuff. And I was hearing it up here, but it wasn't hitting my heart. You know, I was pretty much judging you guys. And I was also working on my plan to make a PowerPoint presentation for you on self-esteem and how to have it. Because you guys would say you were liars, you were cheaters, you were dishonest, you were this, you were that, and I'm like, I am going to help them people. You know, they need my help that I can give them. You know, I'm going to this little counseling class over here on the side, I'm coming in here, and it's like, this is my mission, this is why God did this to me. You know, and I really believe that. I hadn't worked on the steps yet, so, you know, I'm like really Cocoa for Cocoa Puffs up there. You know, and people are asking me if I have a sponsor, and I'm like, well, I don't really need one because I have a college degree. But, you know, and they're like, well, I have one too. And I'm like, well, that's good for you. You're probably a little slower, you know. And seeing some of these people come in that had 20 years and they're still coming in, I'm thinking, can't they get it, you know. And I couldn't understand that. And I also went to a lot of meetings during my lunch break. And, you know, in my mind, it's like, okay, I'm here now. Let's skip over all the readings because you guys have been listening to the same readings for 20-some-odd years. It's not, you know, panning out. Let's just get to the conversation. Let me tell you what my problem is today. You know, I saw a deer get run over today. Let's let's talk about that and how I feel about that. Or let's talk about how come I don't have a driver's license. I don't have money. I've got court costs. Let's talk about me. But they kept reading how it works and the promises. And suddenly that stuff started sinking in. And it's like now when people read the promises and how it works, it just like really hits my heart because that's how this works for me today. And I need to hear it every time I hear it. My grand sponsor, she says that it's kind of like we're carrying around like a little pail of sand, and there's a hole in that pail, and it just seeps out, so we need to keep putting more sand in there. So that's why I need to keep coming to meetings. I need to keep hearing the same thing over and over and over again, because I'll forget things. I mean, there's things I heard when I came in here, and it's like then when somebody says something, like, oh, that is just so profound. This too shall pass. Yeah, I will. That got me through so many things. I'm like, yeah. You know, there's hope that it's going to change. It's not going to be like this forever. You know, I have so much hope today, you know, that life is going to be better for me. You know, one of the things that this program did for me recently, I'm kind of like skipping around and jumping, but that's kind of the way I am. In November, my sister passed away, and it's kind of like I'd never had, you know, to deal with death sober. And that was so hard. It was probably the worst day of my life when my sister died. But you guys gave me hope. I mean, I knew people in the rooms that had lost siblings, children, parents, spouses, and nobody drank behind that I know of. And they helped me get through that process. And it also gave me a chance to really, you know, closen up my relationship with God. And, you know, people were emailing me, texting me, calling me. And I was able to be of service to my family. And parallel to that was when my father passed away, where I just almost died from overdosing and drinking and everything. Then my sister passes away, and I get to have memories of her and help arrange it and put, you know, her to rest, you know, respectfully and do the right thing and be a comfort to my mother. And to be able to allow people to comfort me, because I'm usually like, oh, I got this. You know, I can do everything by myself, but just to be vulnerable and weak and just let people see that I'm a human being and I have hurts too, and it's okay to coddle me if you want to. But so I don't know why I went off on that little side thing, but I did. So anyway, I'm in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and one day after the Lord's Prayer, this little old guy that's holding my hand, he won't turn loose. He says, you really need to get a sponsor. I mean, really. So he said, and I recommend that woman over there. And so I walked up to her, and I couldn't look her in the eye. I didn't look you guys in the eye either when I came in, just because I was ashamed. And plus, I was thinking better of you. I was like planning to fix you and everything. But I went to this woman and told her that guy said I need a sponsor, and she just happily took out a schedule and wrote her name and introduced me to other women in the room and gave me their phone numbers and told me to call her that night, and I did. That is like one of God's first miracles for me, that I called her, and we got my sobriety date, you know, which was the day after I went into my outpatient, because they told me not to drink that night, so I went home and drank. And I wish I could say my last drunk was like really exciting, but I didn't have much money, so I just had a bottle of wine. So, but my last drunk was like, wow, lights, little portable thing, and handcuffs and everything. So my last drunk was pretty bad. So I don't need to like go out and make it any better, because it doesn't get any better. So I started working the steps with this woman. I mean, she told herself about me. It was just like one alcoholic talking to another. We got together, and I mean, she took time to come to my home after she flew back from being somewhere. And I'm thinking, like, this woman has been out of town. She's got a husband at home, and she's going to come straight from the airport to my home to, like, work with me through this thing. Like, maybe I should take, you know, this a little bit seriously. Plus, I'm paying for this little outpatient thing, and I'm protecting my investment by then. I mean, that's the only thing it is for me. Protect my investment and get my driver's license back and, you know, humor this woman. And so we get to the third step, and we do the third step prayers. You guys have probably all done. And then I start working on my inventory, which was like a big task for me, because I didn't think I had any issues. My plan was to get a post-it note, because, you know, I was so perfect. I didn't have any resentments. I didn't have any fears. I didn't have any sexual, improper things. But as the more I started coming around you guys, the more I started hearing what you said and really hearing it instead of, like, talking all the time. Because somebody finally told me, like, I need to keep my mouth shut and listen. You know, keep your eyes open, keep your ears open, just keep your mouth shut. And I started going to more speaker meetings so I could hear other people and how they stayed sober. Because I knew how to stay drunk. I mean, I don't need any help doing that. But staying sober was a big thing for me. And I was afraid of doing an inventory, because once I started writing it down as out of the big book, it got a little bit scary in there. I didn't like what I was starting to see. And then there was this pattern that started taking life, and I'm like, I got a little bit depressed on that. I mean, my mood was like up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. And I'm thinking like, God, I'm ready to do the fifth step now. And then my sister decides to come visit me. I'm 90 days sober, and I'm going to chair my very first meeting, and my sister's coming to stay for a month. Newly sober with somebody else in the house when you live alone, ooh, that was not a good mixture in my mind. And so, of course, my sponsor told me that since I had my sister coming, I hadn't told my family anything, you know, because everything is a big secret in my world. It used to be when I was drinking. I didn't tell anybody anything, what was going on, what was going on with my life at all. And so I had to tell my mother about this. And I wasn't looking forward to it because I knew she was going to be not happy, because I had to tell her full disclosure is what my sponsor said. Don't tell her that you just woke up and thought like, ooh, I'm going to go to AA and stop drinking. You need to tell her about, like, the acts, you know, the police and the court and all that stuff. And that was really hard. I didn't really want to do that because honesty is not my thing. I mean, I lie. I lie a lot. There's a lie I told just 6 months ago, out of the clear blue. I have no children, but I was on my way to my home group, and I decided to stop and get some treats for my home group. So, and something for me to eat for dinner, too. I'll leave that part out. So, I got, like, some little Sweet 16 powdered and some Sweet 16 chocolate donuts from my home group and something for me. And then as I'm checking out, it's like $20 or something. I say, like, God, it's going to be gone in 5 minutes. The checkout lady says, you must have children. Yes, I do. She said, how old are they? 8 and 9? And I said, one likes chocolate and one likes the powder. At least they won't complain over them. They won't fight over them. I'm thinking, like, where did that come from? So then I moved directly into rationalizing it. It's like, well, so-and-so's got 8 years. Yeah, it's been sober 9 years. And then my friend, 17 years, we've got somebody sober 17 years, too. And he says, yeah, that works. So I went to my home group, and I said, I just, like, flat out lied to this lady. I can't go to that food line anymore now. And they said, why did you lie? I'm like, I don't know. So then I started, like, having these dreams about, not dreams, but a memory of something I did, like, as a child. Because, I've been dishonest before I took my first drink. I remember my mom had this piggy bank, which is a little sad looking dog, and I used to steal money out of it to go buy dolls, and I bought the dolls so I could cut their hair and torture them. So, you know, I need to go get new dolls. So I thought, like, why am I waking up every morning and I'm thinking about stealing money from my mother? And then it's like step 8 step 9, maybe, I don't know. So I tell my sponsor about this, and she's like, you need to, she said, how much did you steal approximately? I said, well, you know, I did some calculations, and she's a CPA, so she, you know, factored in some interest and said, well, you know, since, you know, your mom is not close by, send her a check for that much money and put a letter in there and then call her and talk about it with her. I'm like, okay. I mean, I felt real stupid. I mean, I'm thinking, like, I wasn't even drinking yet. But, you know, it's like, it's not, you know, alcohol is just a symptom. I'm pretty screwed up with that. And just add alcohol in there, and it's just, like, really bad. So thank God for this book and these steps to keep me, like, you know, just a little bit better. So then things happened where I had to be home. So I'm thinking, like, oh, great, now I got to go home and take the money with me for my mom. So I kind of, like, was going to do it a little slyly because, you know, I lie a lot, you know, still. So we're in Walmart, and my mom loves Farmville, so she wanted a gift card for, you know, she was going to buy some Farmville stuff. So I said, I'll buy that for you. I will spend X amount of dollars for you on that. I'm like, yeah, I'm working it in there. So I kept it, you know, and I know that I'm not doing the right thing. So, you know, we're sitting at her computer, and I'm, you know, we're just eye to eye. And I just looked at her. I said, Mom, I said, this is a financial amends to you because I stole from you as a child out of your bank. I said, and I'm sorry. I said, I've had to buy some dolls. I said, you gave me everything I needed, but I just wanted dolls. And she's kind of like looked a little bad. She says, you people are just wonderful. And so she took her little money. You know, later in the day, she said, what kind of dolls did you buy? I'm like, oh, I don't remember. I mean, and it's like, it was just like not a big deal. I mean, she didn't stop loving me, didn't withhold love from me or anything because of, you know, I stole from her as a child. Because my brother was always like, he was the high-level bad kid. I was the sneaky one, you know. I was always eavesdropping, stealing, you know, stealing liquor from the people that I babysat cabinets, and my brother was like stealing from the grocery stores and getting caught. You know, I was the sly one, you know, one of those little quiet ones sometimes. So anyway, I'm back to, you know, being sober. So I, you know, when I come into the rooms, I tell my mom that, you know, everything I'd done. And she's like, well, isn't that AA like a cult or something? And I'm like, I checked the internet to the best of my abilities and I didn't find anything bad. I said, they seem like they're nice people. She said, you're gonna have to go to the meetings all your life. I said, well, they say one day at a time. I said, but I'm just going one day at a time right now. But the thought of not ever being able to drink again for my life was just like so enormous for me to, you know, embrace. But one day at a time, I can do that. I mean, sometimes I went to bed like at 8 o'clock, but I knew if I woke up the next day, I'd have got another day under my belt. So that one day at a time does help me a lot. And sometimes I break my days into like 3 hours because I just wake up and it's just like things are going on where I can't take a whole day. And it's not because of the drinking, it's the emotional stuff. It's dealing with people and just work issues and stuff like that. So sometimes I'll just like, you know, do an inventory every 3-4 hours as needed. And that's a gift of this program that I just love. So anyway, I'm back to, you know, my original stuff here. So I told my mom, a sister came, took her to an AA meeting with me. She looked like, this is what your life is reduced to. You know? But then, she, you know, she stayed a whole month, and by about second week there, she's like, don't you have a meeting tonight? You know? And then when I come back, she'd be like, how'd your meeting go? And I'm kind of like, so she started learning that I needed all the help that I could get. And she started, you know, I got to be able to be a sister to her again and a sister to my other sister. So finally she left. I get to do my fifth step with my sponsor. And she says, welcome to AA. And I'm thinking like, okay, I thought this woman knew that I'd been in AA now since September. It's January now. She's telling me, welcome to AA. But, you know, in the 12 and 12 says that once we take our fifth step that we are a part of AA and we can share our experiences in here. And I felt like I was much able to be more honest with you guys after I did my fifth step because I got to, like, say out loud. I mean, it's one thing for me to write it and for me to say, God, look what I did. But another thing to tell another person about that stuff. And, you know, about 95-96% of what's on my inventory is, like, I talk freely from the podium about. And 100% of it I'll talk with a new woman if she needs some of the stuff that's there. Because there was something that one of my sponsees told me one time, and I'm like thinking, like, golly, I forgot about that. I did that too. I forgot about that young poor boy that I, you know, and it made her feel better. And I mean, I wasn't proud of it, but it's just kind of like, had that came out at 90 days, I would have been just horrified, you know. And my sponsor said that, you know, God doesn't give us anything more than what we can handle at one time. You know, I couldn't have handled that then. But then I'm thinking, like, it wasn't great, but I did it. I owned up to it. And it was wrong. And I know it was wrong. And it helped that woman, too, because then she didn't have to be ashamed. You know, doing my inventory, you know, my sponsor's husband said, like, if it's got a name, you didn't create it. Somebody else has done it. It's not that special. And I'm like, true that. But, you know, the goal is not to repeat those behaviors. And with the rest of the steps, I'm able to not repeat those much, some of them. So on to step 6 and 7, I was real happy when it came time to do step 6 because that involved being alone, and I still like being alone. I'm an isolator, but I do get out. You know, I did step 6 and then it's step 7, but then when it came time to do step 8, I was like, I didn't like that part because I'm thinking about step 9 already, and I don't want to tell anybody that I'm wrong. That's another thing I have. I don't want to tell you I'm wrong. I don't want to tell you I don't know, because then you're going to think less of me. So that's when I use my anger, character defect, my anger to keep people away from me. And it worked a lot. I mean, it worked really well at work. Got me in trouble a lot. And I didn't even know I had anger. I read a book on anger, and I saw myself in there. But newly sober, I got to see my anger in action against an inanimate objects. You know, one morning the coffee pot didn't go off. So that threw my whole day off, no coffee, got up late, had to go to work without coffee, and traffic was not moving the way I thought it should be. And that's when I started seeing how my anger could come out. And I didn't need to be with anybody to have anger come out. I also started feeding birds at this time when I'm newly sober because I didn't have anything to do. I mean, I'm awake all the time now. And it's like, what do? I don't want to go do the Perkins thing. I don't want to go do the bowling thing. And I've only taken so many meetings. So I had these elaborate bird feeders, which was great, you know. But then the squirrels started coming and taking the bird feed. And that's when I got to see my anger come out, because I would, like, come running up to the sliding glass doors and pounding on it and threatening them, because my dad hunted squirrels, and we ate them as we were children. I mean, I grew up on a farm. We ate them. I'm just thinking, like, you'd be glad my dad is not here, because he would shoot you, and we'd be eating you for stew tonight. I mean, just, like, high drama stuff. And I'm thinking, like, why am I so angry about this, you know? So, I mean, and then I start, like, seeing how I was angry with people, you know, and when my sponsor would observe me in a meeting, she's like, you need to go over there and correct that. And I'm like, oh, well, they did this. Let's worry about your side of the street. Today I worry about my side of the street, because there's a lot going on my side of the street. You do what you need to do over there on your side of the street, but I need to stay over here and keep my little broom and just keep sweeping up. So one of my amends that I got to make long distance was to my brother in California. Me and him, growing up, we were just like this, you know, because we're closest in age, and we just, like, hung out a lot, and we partied a lot together and everything. But something happened maybe like 19 years earlier, and we just hadn't spoken. You know, he didn't want me to have his phone number because, you know, I'd make those little drunk calls that weren't appropriate and say inappropriate things to his wife and girlfriends or whoever was in his world. And so he just finally just, like, wouldn't let me have his phone number anymore. And so as a result of that, my sponsor told me to write him a letter and tell him everything, again, the whole disclosure thing. So it took me a couple of revisions before I got it done right, and I mailed him a letter with my phone number in it. And he called me and left a message, and now we talk nowadays. And since then, I've been able to make amends to him in person, because we've been home to Kansas a lot together. And we're not, like, real close, because he still drinks and does things, and he doesn't understand my way of life, and that's okay. At least we can communicate. We can share information that needs to be shared today. One of my favorite amends is, like, one that just kind of, like, came on the fly when I was able to, I was driving to work, because I lived in a little town in North Carolina, Morrisville, actually. And I lived close to the police department, because when I bought my property there, my goal was to, like, be by the police department so I could be safe. And then I was the menace to society, driving drunk all the time. But anyway, I saw my policeman, like, he's my policeman now, but I saw my police, the guy, the arresting officer, I saw him, and I decided, like, you know, I should thank that man for saving my life, because I was 18 months sober then, and I hadn't seen him ever since then. So I turned around and, you know, was running through the parking lot, Officer Coyne, I said, do you remember me? He says, oh, yes, Ms. Brown, I remember you. So I just, you know, I had my medallion, I whipped that in my pocket and said, hey, I'm sober now, thanks to you. And I said, just thank you for stopping me that night and saving my life and saving whoever else's life. And, yeah, it was a nice time, and we hugged and everything. And he was able to share with me that his father was in a nursing home dying from alcoholism. And it's like he was just happy to know that he had had an impact on somebody's life. So I wrote a letter to his police chief or whatever those people are above him, and I just thanked him for that. I mean, and that just warmed my heart. He said, like, he sees so much violence and death out there. It's nice to see that things that he does in his line of duty are helping other people. So my life is starting to get good, and the promises are coming true, and I'm thinking, like, I'm not going to do any more amends because life is good. And then there's this woman that comes to my home group that needs a ride, you know, home. She's from out of state. So I'm like, I'm giving her a ride home, and, you know, she'd picked up, I think, a 2-year chip that night. And she said, well, you know, I had, you know, I don't know, 12 years, she said, but I didn't do all my amends when I had the opportunity to do them, and I drank again. And it's just like, you know, the hair on my neck just went up. Like, I guess I better get back on them amends. So I got back to work. You know, because God has to thump me on the head pretty hard sometimes, you know, before I listen. Now when I get that intuitive thought that I know is the right thing to do, I mean, I know the difference between right and wrong. I mean, it started out like against the law or legal. I mean, that's how basic it had to be for me. But now I know. So I continue on with my amends as they come up. And I, you know, prayer and meditation, I'm getting better with that. I'm getting a lot better with that, actually. It's a very important thing for me to do, because I used to just, like, read, like, romance novels and horror novels, but now I'm reading books on, you know, hope and just on love and how to be more godlike, and, you know, and I read the Bible. I go to church regularly and actually am present there. I used to go just because my mother wanted me to go. And I'd sit there, and I wouldn't be able to tell you, like, an hour later what was said, who was said, where they read from or anything, because I didn't really care. I'd say, like, yeah, I put on some pantyhose and I went to church today. And that was it. Now I go because I want to go, because I need that part of me too. I mean, I have a lot of needs that I need, but most of my needs are met here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And some of the cool things that have happened to me is, like, in 2008, the company that I worked for was sold to a larger company, and in order to keep my continued employment there with this company, I needed to move. So I got to move from North Carolina to Virginia. Boy, oh boy, talk about some character defects just popping up. You know, I'm just like, so I was like, 3 years sober when I moved? And I was able to, before I moved, I was able to sit with my sponsor and look her in the eye and ask her to be my sponsor going forward. And she told me I had to be accountable for myself and told me the same conditions, minimum 4 meetings, call me once a week, call me whenever you need to, but call and check in at least once a week, because for me, my life would be going so good, I'm thinking, like, I ain't calling in, everything is going great, you know, or I'll solve everything myself. But it's an amazing thing when I call and check in, she usually finds something. You know, I try to hide it cleverly and stuff, but she usually digs it out, and because I'm just, like, saying stuff, and she listens to me all the time. So, but moving to Virginia, I had to do, like, 90 and 90. And I'm thinking, like, I did 88, and I got to see who goes to meetings, where the meetings are, and, you know, how to build an island. And it's like I had a little bit of trouble doing that, you know, because I try to, like, get meetings in that were convenient for me. And any time that I try to do things that are too convenient for me, it's like it doesn't work out too well. When I put AA first and, like, do what I know I need to do, and then the rest of my life just kind of falls in place around it. But moving was a struggle, and it doesn't have to be a struggle, because I'd watch other people when they moved and they just, like, slid right in, got into service and did it. Thank God for service work. You know, my group let me be their GSR. I got a home group immediately, and I changed home groups after I moved here. But I got to be GSR, meet other people and do service work and, you know, go out to dinner with people. And just, like, it was just like being a new girl with a couple years sobriety. And I'm grateful that I did that. I've got to come here and speak, and, you know, my life has been pretty good since I've moved here. I sponsor women when asked. I don't have any current sponsees right now. It's kind of like a bare season right now. I mean, we've got a lot of people coming in and going back out again, and it's like this disease is deadly. I've seen people